Tune in to CKUT 90.3 FM, Tuesdays, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m., for a special Black History Month edition of the Montreal Sessions. The month kicks off on February 1st with the best in reggae and soca with your hosts, Production Sounds and Soca Head. Week 2, February 8th, Wizzy Moonchaser, host of the Morning Detour, broadcast live from DG Kicks, a sneaker store in NDG. Final 2 weeks, 15th and 22nd, are hosted by Stephen Ziplocks Hennessy, educator, creator,
and part of the Ill Groove Garden team. Don't miss it.
Following is a previously broadcast program.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
According to the information we have, the enemy has marked me as target number one, my family as target number two. They want to damage Ukraine politically by destroying the head of state.
As the Russian army moves in on Kyiv and threatens to topple the Ukrainian government, the Ukrainian military is urging citizens to make Molotov cocktails to attack the approaching Russian army. We'll speak with a Ukrainian journalist in Kyiv and a Ukrainian peace activist who just fled the country.
I feel that I fail after many years. I spent a lot of time and a lot of forces and a lot of strength and a lot of time for peace building, for promoting peace, for dialogue, for mediations through different groups. And now all this not useful anymore because we are under the attack, under aggression.
Plus, Russian troops have seized the site of the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear disaster and have reportedly taken staff hostage. We'll look at what could happen if one of Ukraine's active nuclear plants is bombed or loses power.
We're also equally concerned about the four nuclear power plant sites, 15 reactors in total in Ukraine, which are operating right now. If any one of them were to be attacked or to melt down, they would release much more radioactivity than got out during the Chernobyl accident in 1986. So this could be a humanitarian catastrophe, not only for Ukraine, but also for Russia, Belarus, and all of Europe.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Columns of Russian tanks and armored vehicles are advancing on Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, and have reached the outskirts of the city after a second night of heavy Russian shelling and airstrikes. U.S. intelligence officials view the military offensive as a move to encircle Kyiv and topple the Ukrainian government, something they warn could happen within days. On Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin gathered Russia's wealthy men for a meeting just hours after Russian forces began a sweeping attack on Ukraine by land, by air, and by sea. Putin said he had no choice but to attack in order to ensure Russia's security.
Everything that is happening is a desperate measure. They left us no other option. They've created such security risks that we couldn't react differently.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he's remaining in the capital, Kyiv, despite threats to his life. On Thursday, he vowed to defend Ukraine while saying he's open to talks with Russia and discussing the issue of neutrality. Zelensky has ordered a full military mobilization, with all men aged 18 to 60 ordered to remain in Ukraine to face possible conscription into military service. Elsewhere Thursday, Russian forces captured the Chernobyl nuclear power plant after a fierce battle, raising fears of a new nuclear disaster. The White House expressed alarm over what it called credible reports that staff at the Chernobyl plant are being held hostage. The United Nations warns over 100,000 Ukrainians have been displaced by Russia's assault, with thousands fleeing to other European countries. This is UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi.
The humanitarian consequences on civilian populations will be devastating. There are no winners in war, but countless lives will be torn apart. We have already seen reports of casualties and people starting to flee their homes to seek safety.
Across Russia, thousands of people risk police violence to protest Vladimir Putin's decision to invade Ukraine, despite government warnings that dissent would be met with severe punishment. Human rights groups say at least 1,800 people have been arrested at demonstrations in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and other cities across Russia. Meanwhile, anti-war protests were held across the United States and in cities around the world, including New York, Tokyo, Taipei, London, Paris, and Berlin. The Pentagon's ordered 7,000 additional U.S. troops to deploy to Germany. President Biden's also directed Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin to move U.S. forces in Europe to Poland and the Baltic republics bordering Russia. On Thursday, Biden announced the U.S. would tighten its sanctions against Russia, with new measures targeting Russian banks, energy producers, weapons makers, and wealthy families close to President Putin. But Biden stopped short of directly sanctioning Putin or kicking Russia out of the global SWIFT banking system.
This aggression cannot go unanswered. If it did, the consequences for America would be much worse. America stands up to bullies. We stand up for freedom.
Seven-nation European Union also announced new sanctions on Russia, as did Japan, South Korea, Australia, and other U.S. allies. After headlines, we'll spend the rest of the hour on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The U.S. launched an airstrike in Somalia Tuesday, its first in the country since August last year. U.S. Africa Command said the strike was carried out under the authorization of use for military force in response to an al-Shabaab attack on partner forces. This comes amidst a spate of deadly suicide attacks, and as Somalia remains in political turmoil, once again extending parliamentary elections that were supposed to be completed by today to next month. Meanwhile, Save the Children has warned millions are going hungry and hundreds of thousands are being displaced as Somalia faces its worst drought in a decade. Syrian state television reported Israeli missiles hit near the capital, Damascus, Thursday, killing three soldiers. It's the fourth Israeli airstrike on Syria this month and comes a day after missiles that were launched from the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights struck the Syrian border province of Kuntirj. Israel says its attacks target Syrian government positions, Iran-backed militias, and Hezbollah fighters. President Biden's expected to announce his pick for the next U.S. Supreme Court justice today. This comes exactly 2 years after Biden vowed on the campaign trail to nominate the first Black woman Supreme Court justice. The top contenders believed to be federal judge and former public defender Ketanji Brown Jackson. Other contenders include South Carolina federal judge J. Michelle Childs and Leandra Kruger, a justice on the California Supreme Court. In coronavirus news, the Centers for Disease Control is expected to announce a relaxation of its mask guidance today, allowing most people to forgo them in public indoor spaces. The new guidance will rely more heavily on the rate of hospitalizations rather than just caseloads to determine if masks are recommended. Most states have already lifted or significantly eased their mask mandates. Recorded cases have dropped by around two-thirds from 2 weeks ago, though daily deaths are still averaging close to 2,000. In Minnesota, three former Minneapolis police officers have been found guilty of violating George Floyd's civil rights. On Thursday, a federal judge found J. Alexander King, Thomas Lane, and Tu Tao each failed in their duties on May 25, 2020, as they ignored Floyd's repeated pleas of "I can't breathe," while Officer Derek Chauvin pressed his knee into Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes, murdering him. Two of the officers also helped Chauvin physically restrain Floyd, while one officer prevented passers-by from helping. Federal prosecutor Charles Kovats spoke after the verdict.
These officers had a moral responsibility, a legal obligation, and a duty to intervene. And by failing to do so, they committed a crime. This is a reminder that all sworn law enforcement officers, regardless of rank or seniority, individually and independently, have a duty to intervene and provide medical aid to those in their custody.
The three officers remain free on bond until their sentencing hearing. They still face a state trial in June on charges of aiding and abetting George Floyd's murder. Floyd's family welcomed Thursday's verdict, which they said should serve as an example for police departments around the country. This is George Floyd's nephew, Brandon Williams.
Oftentimes, you know, officers kill black and brown men and women, and we get little to no consequences. A lot of times, we don't even get charges, let alone a conviction. Mm-hmm. You know, so we'll take this small victory, you know, and smile about it and be happy. But deep down, we're still hurting. You know, we want this to stop.
A judge in Michigan has ordered the parents of an alleged teenage gunman to stand trial for involuntary manslaughter. 15-year-old Ethan Crumbley is being charged as an adult with first-degree murder, terrorism and gun charges over last November's shooting at Oxford High School, which killed students Hannah St. Juliana, Tate Meir, Justin Schilling and Madison Baldwin. Seven others were injured in the assault. On Thursday, a judge said there was enough evidence to merit a trial for Crumbley's parents, Jennifer and James Crumbley, who allegedly gave the gun used in the shooting to their son as an early Christmas present. Prosecutors say the pair failed to intervene when their son showed clear signs of mental distress in the weeks leading up to the massacre. An Oakland County sheriff's detective testified the teen's journal contained disturbing images and repeated graphic entries about his plans.
Toward the bottom half of the page, it says, "First off, I got my gun. It's a SP 2022 6-hour 9mm. Second, the shooting is tomorrow, comma, I have access to the gun and ammo."
Jennifer and James Crumbley remain jailed on $500,000 bond. If convicted of involuntary manslaughter, they each face up to 60 years in prison. Immigrant justice advocates are demanding Amazon divest from an air cargo holding company whose subsidiaries include Omni Air International, which carries out deportation flights for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as the ICE Air program. The Intercept reports Amazon purchased a percentage of Air Transport Services Group, the company that owns Omni Air, for some $131 million last year. Activists have long exposed abuse faced by asylum seekers on Omni Air deportation flights. In 2017, deported asylum seekers returned to Somalia in an Omni Air flight were reportedly beaten and restrained with straitjackets. In another incident in 2012, a Salvadoran asylum seeker miscarried her triplets aboard a removal flight to El Salvador. And in New York, immigrant rights leader Ravi Ragbir has been granted 3 years of deferred action, allowing him to stay in the United States to fight for permanent immigration relief. The settlement is part of a First Amendment lawsuit filed by Ragbir and several immigrant justice groups accusing Immigration and Customs Enforcement of targeting and retaliating against activists. In January 2018, Ravi Ragbir was detained during a check-in with ICE and was ordered deported. He recorded this message before his apprehension.
"I hope and I pray that you will step out of your comfort zone to create a network of safety, not just in the houses of worship, not just in the space where we call sensitive zone, but create a network of safety around you and around the community, because you refuse to let this agency act, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. You are refusing to let them come in to your community and destroy it and take away those families only because they don't have one piece of paper. Our humanity is not dependent on a piece of paper."
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russian troops have entered the northern district of the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv in what is seen as part of a move to encircle the city and topple the Ukrainian government. At least one apartment building in Kyiv was set ablaze today after being hit by a rocket. This comes a day after Russia launched a sweeping attack on Ukraine by land, air and sea. The Ukrainian government's now urging citizens to make Molotov cocktails to help defend the country. Ukrainian forces have also blown up a key bridge north of the city in an attempt to slow the Russian advance. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he's remaining in the capital despite threats to his life. On Thursday, he vowed to defend Ukraine while saying he's open to talks with Russia and discussing the issue of neutrality.
Today, I have asked 27 European leaders whether Ukraine will be in NATO. I have asked directly. Everyone is afraid. No one answers. But we are not afraid. We are not afraid of anything. We are not afraid to defend our country. We are not afraid of Russia. We are not afraid to talk to Russia. We are not afraid to talk about anything, about security guarantees for our country. We are not afraid of talking about neutrality. We are not NATO members at the moment. But what guarantees will we get? And most importantly, which countries will give us those guarantees? I remain in the capital. My family is also in Ukraine. My children are in Ukraine. My family are not traitors. They are citizens of Ukraine. Where exactly they are, I have no right to say. According to the information we have, the enemy has marked me as target number one, my family as target number two. They want to damage Ukraine politically by destroying the head of state.
The Ukrainian president also said 137 Ukrainian civilians and military personnel were killed in the opening day of the Russian invasion. Ukraine claims it's killed as many as 800 Russian soldiers, but there has been no verification of the claim. Russia's claiming it's destroyed over 115 military facilities in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the United Nations says over 100,000 Ukrainians have been displaced, with thousands fleeing to other European countries. In Washington, President Biden condemned Russia's invasion.
Putin is the aggressor. Putin chose this war. And now he and his country will bear the consequences.
During a speech at the White House, Biden announced new sanctions against Russia, but stopped short of directly sanctioning Putin or kicking Russia out of the global SWIFT banking system. On Thursday, the Pentagon ordered 7,000 more troops to Germany. NATO's holding emergency talks today about the crisis. In Moscow, Putin told a group of Russian business leaders he had no choice but to attack Ukraine in order to ensure Russia's security. This comes as anti-war protesters are rallying around the globe, calling for Russia to halt its invasion. In Russia, authorities arrested 1,800 people calling for peace on Thursday. Most of the arrests occurred in Moscow and St. Petersburg. We begin the show in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, where we're joined by the Ukrainian journalist Natalia Gumanuk. She just wrote a harrowing piece for The Guardian headlined, "I'm in Kyiv and awake at the darkest hour as Putin's bombs rain down." She's the founder of the Public Interest Journalist Lab. Her work focuses on international security and conflict reporting and human rights. She's spent a lot of time covering Donbas. Natalia, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you describe the situation, where you are right now, what the people of Kyiv and Ukraine are facing?
Good to talk to you. I'm in Kyiv, in the capital. I'm so far working from my home, trying to, understand where I'm able to go. A lot of people, they were called to stay in the basement. The Ukrainian underground is quite deep, so quite a lot of people spend their nights there. There was a call from the government to stay at home, not to really get out, though hospitals are working, transportation is free. And I should probably stress then what is possible to do to make the civilians' kind of life normal. We're fortunate to have cell phones, internet so far, electricity and water. But of course, it's developing very, very fast. There was a saboteur groups in one of the residential areas. We know that the Russian military were killed, that it was stopped. We, of course, follow, videos, photos. I'm, of course, obviously, as a journalist myself, have a lot of colleagues, have a lot of sources. services online, a lot could be done. And things are happening all across the country, but it's clear that there is an attempt to overtake Kyiv. But I'd like to stress that for more than like 32 hours, the Ukrainian army is really deterring this mighty force on its own.
Can you talk, Natalia, about an interview you did? You wrote about this with a Russian journalist when she called you.
Yeah, I'm in touch with a lot of Russian journalists, independent journalists. They are often in a position they are forbidden to work in their country. So as there were the first signs of the war, there was a shelling in the capital as well, and it was clear yesterday night that it started. It's a full scale. It's something unthinkable. I've got the call. I don't know the person. I know by name. She's very famous to ask, like, what is happening? Like, is it true? But she started to beg for forgiveness. She started to talk that she begs for forgiveness to what her country does for her, and she feels powerless, as a lot of Russians do, as a lot of Russian liberals. So I was, like, telling what's going on, and she asked to compare. You know, like she asked to compare, and I said, like, you know, it'd be stupid. I mean, I don't like this comparison. I think we too often misuse the term of the Second World War, Hitler, you know, in the public speeches everywhere as an anecdote. But because she's Russian and I'm kind of from, we are both from the post-Soviet space. We were grew up in these stories about Second World War. The Hitler attack started at 4 a.m. in 1941 with bombing Kyiv. And it was 5 a.m. and Putin bombed Kyiv. And that's a reference that all people in post-Soviet space feel very strong. And it's happening. And it can be, you know, different. And that's how Ukrainians felt. And it was very important to you know, I'm not that emotional person. I'm trying to keep calm. But I think we kind of cried a bit because of the, you know, like this tragedy of the moment, because I don't want it. She don't want it. Our citizens don't want it. I mean, a huge portion of the Russians don't want it. There is no any other reason rather than madness, rather than hatred of Vladimir Putin to Ukraine, which within the last couple of months and within the last years actually demonstrated to the very, very last moment that it's ready to avoid the war, that it's really, you know, it's all about the defense. And now we're living in a very different reality.
Do you have a sense Kyiv will fall as early as today or in the next few days?
No, my sense is very different, of course. I might be wishful thinking. Actually, now, like, reading to what my colleagues saying, they are, in fact, very disappointed by the Western kind of tone that it's a matter of hours. We see that, you know, I cannot independently verify how, you know, like, whether the Ukrainian army, to what extent it was successful, you know, how many there are casualties among the Russian troops. You know, like, the country is big. It's as big as France. You know, like, so none of the media would be capable to verify it. But the resilience which has been shown already by the legit Ukrainian army is really big. Because, like, the prediction where I felt like sometimes it was said, like, oh, it's a matter now of hours. It's not a matter of hours. I think that Ukraine is way stronger than the many people think. But of course, it feels like we are long. And the strength is formidable. So that's really different. And I, to add, you know, I'm by my views, by, you know, I covered conflict and I do report them from the humanitarian side. I, you know, if there are journalists who cover war from the military point of view, I'm always with the civilians. I'm always kind of very much for pro-peace. But at this moment, you just know that in such circumstances, it's just the legit army. In the democratic country, where in a pluralistic society, which is trying to hold on. And even though there would be very severe damage, you know, like the longer it lasts, it also means there would be more damage done to Ukraine, to Ukrainian cities. There would be innocent victims and casualties. But the deterrence is very strong. I feel like very, you know, warm. I feel very supported by everybody. I feel like everybody does his or her best. And in particularly, I'm like at core of the civil society. I'm, you know, like my friends and my circle is like super active people. So there were never doubts about what they would do. But I'm looking at like every civilian, like not every, I don't want to overdo, but too many, those who we would consider apolitical, those who would we would consider that they just prefer to live their normal life. Those who can, they stay in the town, they send the kids and parents, you know, they stand the, but they stand here to do something.
Can you talk about what it is that, how your family is preparing right now? Your husband, also a journalist. We're hearing about hundreds of people going into the subways as underground bomb shelters, not knowing what else to do. Thousands going over the border, what, into places like Poland. 100,000 displaced in Ukraine right now. And those numbers, of course, could mount. So how you both are doing your journalism and also preparing your own family?
So, yeah, Ukraine is 40 million. It has a border with Poland. We're having requests. We're receiving like offers from a lot of people in the western part of the country to host. People have relatives. People are really moving from the areas of like a bigger danger. My sister managed to get out of the town, but not far away. I'm kind of exactly considering how would it be possible to kind of bring my mom today to the train. We are like in New York. It's a megapolis. We don't all, everybody own cars, so I don't drive. I should find a way with the public transportation to do that because Uber isn't really working. With my husband, to be honest, like, probably that's a moment when I really do not care what is professional, what is personal. He's a bit like too brave, you know, like he's a bit careless person. So I'm really worried. He went like somewhere where it's really dangerous now. And I don't share. I think he should be, you know, like a bit more concerned, but I know him. It won't happen, but so makes me a bit angry. But because I kind of more care, I'm more careful while working outside. I'm trying to understand, like, should I be here with you talking, but being in my room? Or should I go out? Where should I go? It's all everywhere. Would it have any impact if I go there, if I would tweet, if I would, you know, make a broadcast to any foreign station? It would matter, but which moment, for how long we should be in this situation? You know, like, I've forgotten to eat for 2 days. Now I understood, like, I have to, I don't really want, but like, should I sleep? Should we do it in the shifts? Should I move the table to a different corner of the room? So further from the windows, because who knows, maybe there would be shelling. At what moment I could leave the house, to what distance? Because we're journalists, and again, I probably received this question, but I report this conflict, you know, like that's my profile. That's something I have to do. You know, like these are like, we are like on duty. It's not our task to leave. We should be the ones who would stay to as long as possible. But I want to convey this message of confidence. Really, like this talks about like in how much will, how many hours would it take. I receive the support from friends, you know, people whom I know, you know, like from even like weird places, like from Mali to Tuvalu, people send support and I appreciate it. But I think that the trust into Ukrainian society should be also there, not just support, but the trust that we are really doing something special. And it's not just for Ukraine. It's really about the rules of this world.
Now, Natalia, the president who says he is marked as target number one, his family target number two, now says that men can't leave between the ages of 18 and 60. They can't leave Ukraine. They're calling on all people to prepare with Molotov cocktails to face off the Russian army. I'm wondering if you could comment on this and also how this compares to you talk about your husband being brave, but you too. You've been covering Donbas, the eastern region, for a long time. Can you talk about how this compares to that conflict area?
Okay. So I don't really would stress on the Molotov cocktails. There was also the calls for the people to, conscript to fight in the territorial defense. And that was just like additional on top of that. I can't verify it myself, but I like see the photos and in towns there are lines to the, where the males are, and not just men, but women also trying to join the army. But yeah, probably people should be ready for the guerrilla war. So far, it's always legit. It's very different from the conflict in the Donbas. You know, at that time, Russia still pretended to not to be there. It was there, but they pretended that, you know, like those separatists they backed, they didn't have the they didn't have, for instance, Air Force or Navy, because those separatists, as if they bought their guns or like that book, Missiles Rocket, which shot the MH17 jet, that they bought it somewhere in the free market. Now, so there was a limited. It was dangerous. It was bad, but it was limited somehow. It was mainly artillery. Now it's a full-scale invasion. Russia knows the military targets in Ukraine thanks to the old Soviet maps. So, like, every single, like, military unit, which doesn't make sense, like, warehouse was attacked. And the border is very long. Also, Belarus joined Russia in this. The Belarus, another neighbor country with the regime of Lukashenko, is kind of it's used as a theater, as the place. So it's really could be compared just like of the biggest wars of as the bigger war since the Second World War with the mighty force which is there. It's again, Ukraine is as large as France. And it's attacked in the huge part of its territory with not limited. You know, like, I think like a lot of countries we can refer, I know quite well, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq, but it was still a limited amount of people flying to some different continent, with some targets. There we have like the country like Russia, one the biggest in the globe, with one of the mightiest army, is trying to overtake quite a big country with a huge number of people. What I still think, like, what are in the minds of those 150,000 Russian soldiers. The Russian war is not popular in Russia. The Russian television, official television, they don't mention this war. It's not exist for them. I'm puzzled how it could be possible in the modern world for how long. That really something quite historical, unfortunately.
Natalia Gumenyuk, we want to thank you for being with us. Please be safe. Ukrainian journalist based in Kyiv, whose harrowing piece for The Guardian is headlined, "I'm in Kyiv and awake at the darkest hour as Putin's bombs rain down." We'll link to that piece at democracynow.org. She's the founder of Public Interest Journalist Lab, her work focusing on international security, conflict reporting and human rights, speaking to us from Ukraine's capital. When we come back, we'll speak with a woman who has left Ukraine, a Ukrainian peace activist who just fled, is now in Sharm el-Sheikh. Stay with us.
When strangers are coming, they come to your house. They kill you all and say, "We're not guilty, not guilty." Where's your mind? Humanity cries. You think you are God, but everyone dies. Don't swallow my soul, our souls.
Oh,
44 by the Ukrainian singer Jamala. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we're also joined by a Ukrainian peace activist who just fled the country earlier this week. Nina Potarska is the coordinator for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in Ukraine. She's set to speak Saturday as part of an international emergency online rally calling for no war in Ukraine, no to NATO, organized by the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Code Pink, and others. She's joining us from Egypt. Nina Potarska, welcome to Democracy Now! Please explain your circumstances. So you have left Ukraine now, and your child is still in Ukraine?
Yes. I was able to fly on the last charter planes to Egypt, because there was not any other options. And my daughter was ill with the COVID, so it was not possible to...
Your daughter has COVID?
Yes, in the same time.
How old is she?
Because, you know, she's 11. And now, yesterday, they left Kyiv together with her father, and they were on the road near 30 hours. And now they are together with her father, walking to Poland border, maybe 8 kilometers, because it's a lot of cars. And they want to join another part of my family, mother and wife of my brother. So, and...
Between the ages of 18 and 60, can't...
Yeah. Yeah, men are not allowed to go out, and they are all under the military duties. So I'm now, immediately now, they try to pass the border. And I'm really nervous, because if it's possible to go by alone to her, because she's 11. And so it's a big drama for every family now, because some are trying to escape from Kyiv, because in Kyiv now it's really hard. Somebody tried to reach Poland and spending many hours close to the border. And I'm really grateful for our Polish friends and colleagues who are helping us in the close to the border and helping with the cars, with food, with everything we need.
And Nina, so, I want to thank you for being with us, because I know this is an incredibly difficult time for you. You are both dealing with all of this personally, as well as doing your political work. You're going to participate with a Code Pink online rally tomorrow. And it's a rally that says no to war, and as well as no to NATO. And I'm wondering if you can talk about your response to the Russian invasion and what you think needs to happen now.
You know, in this conflict, I don't want to take any party, because it's like, it's unbelievable, like it's a bad movie, because I'm with this conflict from the very beginning, from the 2014. And I know how to be in the shelling, under the shelling from one side and from another side. And, you know, the people, it's a fear the same. And it's not mean that which bombs is better, NATO bombs or Russian bombs. And we know that NATO also doing a lot of very terrible things, but in different parts of this world. But this time it's maybe Russia time. And of course, now I feel that we are like alone, hey, faced with this threat, because in the one hand, Russia attacked us. And in the another hand, the Western partners, and you also were our Western partners, like refused to do anything. And today we receive information that we are like, there are no agreement because of about SWIFT shutdown. So it was like a joke, really. It's just one that everybody can suggest us. I feel that my country now, it's like a battlefield for all countries' ambition, NATO parts and Russia parts. and two imperialistic countries want to divide my country. And I just want to stress one very simple idea that this is not a movie. We are real people. And we are die like a real people. And real children cry because of the explosion everywhere. It's not matter in Ukraine or in Afghanistan or in Syria. We all alive people and we want to be in peace. And I beg you, stay human and not close the borders, not close this help for civilian population. And third, stop this nightmare for all this world and stop this treat each other because and cut the stakes because it's time to get back a little bit to diplomatic mechanism. And I'm really excuse because I'm so angry, maybe because I'm so far and I feel that I need just coordinate and be together with media to because all my colleagues now in stress and help other people just to survive. And all my colleagues have no opportunity to speak aloud. And if our leaders really shy to be human because it's not time to be strong and not time to be masculine. It's not time to be so patriarchal because we are going to hell everywhere. And if it's really difficult to stay in this human level, ask us to help you because we can sit together with you and just hold your hand to remind that where is the humanity? Because it's terrible what is going on in this world. I'm in touch with a lot of women from all over the world and with a woman who suffer from conflict around all of this world. It's terrible. And I believe 2 years ago that COVID turned our mind to new reality when we have to care about each other, when strong country need help weak countries. But no, now it's like a stupid drama. I'm sorry.
Well, Nina Potarska, I want to thank you for being with us. All the best to your daughter, 11 years old, on the border with Poland right now, with her father. Men can't leave Ukraine. The Ukrainian government has called on all men 18 to 60 to stay in the country. Nina Potarska is the coordinator for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in Ukraine, set to speak Saturday as part of the International Emergency Online Rally, calling for no war in Ukraine and no to NATO, that is organized by the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Code Pink, and others. She was speaking to us from Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. As we continue to cover Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we're joined by Katrina Vandenhoevel, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine, columnist for The Washington Post. Katrina, you've reported for decades on Russia. You last joined us a few days ago. On Friday, the situation in Ukraine looks very different. Lay out your response to what you call in your latest piece, Putin's invasion.
I will tell you that people who have studied Russia for decades, I think of Ambassador Jack Matlock, who was on your program, were surprised, if not shocked, even by the recognition of the independence of Donetsk and Luhansk republics, but the special military operations which occurred early morning U.S. time on, I believe, Wednesday, has really shaken a community which did see if there was any glimmer of light in all of this madness, an upsurge of diplomacy. And I think the abrupt ending to that has marked an indefensible military operation, which we've heard about in very human terms. NATO is clearly at the root of the crisis. Putin, in his speech, rambling, aggrieved speech the other day, talked about NATO several times. You've heard it from your guests. The sadness and war is a crime, a tragedy, and a defeat, is that it wasn't on offer, the NATO position for Ukraine. And so there's this delusional quality. I do think the humanitarian story has to be focused on very clearly. The questions to President Biden at his press conference yesterday, as I understand, it was all about military operations and sanctions. But the displacement of perhaps more millions of people than we discussed is going to be upend Europe and be very grave with implications. I am want to pick up on one of your Ukrainian journalist who was powerful. It is the case that it is a different moment in Russia. This is not 2014 in Crimea, when the seizure of Crimea led Putin to soar in popularity. This is a different Russia, COVID, economic problems. There is protest across the country, Amy, as you spoke of, more than 1,500 protests in 50 cities, obviously Moscow, St. Petersburg, more people. But also very interesting, for example, we've talked about Novaya Gazeta, the independent newspaper. It came out yesterday in Russian and in Ukrainian. It is part of a group called Syndicate 100, Reporters Without Borders, and issued a very tough statement. 100 municipal political figures around the country have protested Putin's special operations, and there are more. So this is growing. This is not going to boost Putin's popularity. I don't want to say never, because in the first days of war, things always happen of boosting quality. But I do think, and I'll finish, the momentous implications for our country, for Europe, for Russia, for Ukraine. I mean, you're looking at the risk of nuclear war. I know you're going to talk about that. NATO, more U.S. troops on the front lines, perhaps. NATO will soar in, you know, demand for a while. Energy. We're going to see higher oil and natural gas prices, and there'll be a pressure to increase reliance on fossil fuels. What do we do about that in terms of coping with climate change needs, the crisis which we don't pay enough attention to, and Ukraine and the economy? These sanctions may well have collateral damage in Europe and our country. And that could be, and of course, renewed militarism. If there's anything bipartisan at the moment in Washington, D.C., it's this renewed militarism, adding more weapons, adding more money to the defense budget. My column ends at thenation.com. Let's find a way forward. There has to be a way to talk, even on the margins, about conventional force agreements or the international nuclear INF. Not today, but let us keep that diplomatic escalation, not military escalation, in mind.
The Intercept's Ken Klippenstein reported Wednesday Saudi Arabia is working with Russia to drive up gas prices amidst the Ukraine crisis. He interviewed Bruce Riedel, the Brookings Institution and former CIA analyst, who said, quote, Putin and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman have much in common, including murdering their critics at home and abroad, intervening in their neighbors by force, and trying to get oil prices as high as possible. Putin will do MBS a great service if he invades Ukraine and sends oil prices through the roof. Meanwhile, the Daily Poster had a report Thursday on how Biden's Ukraine plans face Wall Street roadblock to sanctions aimed at Putin and his oligarchs, and that noted, quote, inflicting financial pain on Putin and his wealthy cronies could force the Russian government to the negotiating table. But while such a move might help deter further Russian incursions, Biden faces a significant obstacle. Corporate lobbyists' success in shrouding the American finance industry in secrecy, which makes it far easier for Russian oligarchs and their business empires to evade economic sanctions. Can you comment on this, Katrina?
No, this is serious. This is very serious. The price of oil is over $100 a barrel. There's no question that this is Russia's, you know, quote, ace in the hole. The one thing I'll say about the sanctions, the oligarchs, this is an interesting point, because Putin's tried to repatriate their money for years. This may play a role. And I think it's critical to understand the complicity of a U.S. European Saudi corporate structure in enabling the oligarchs to loot, to hide money. That could not happen without, it doesn't just, you know, happen on its own. So this is a serious issue, and there is great reporting. And Russian media, two or three major papers have been part of it. Pandora's Box, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. I will say, however, one thing, it may push Saudi Arabia and Russia together, but I think the larger story is how these events of the last hours may push Russia and China together. I think that's a big story. They're not going to be partners. They're not going to be friends by any measure, but there is a transactional element. As Russia, seeing the Westernizers inside Russia undermined in the last years by different factors, Putin will turn east most likely. And that's not just to China, but it's to parts of the world which, you know, the NATO Western crowd doesn't consider often legitimate, but it's real. I noticed that China, I believe, is going to buy a massive amount of wheat from Russia. And there will be other purchases, not just from China, that will enable Russia, sadly, probably, to overtake the sanctions. But, Amy, the real problem with sanctions, as we know, is sanctions are another form of warfare. And they often, and I've seen this over the years, hit ordinary Russians who then do feel that the U.S. or those sanctioning are the enemy.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine. We'll link to your latest piece in The Nation, Putin's Invasion. Coming up, Russian troops have seized the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, that disaster. We will talk about nuclear power and nuclear war in the midst of this Russian invasion. Stay with us. Lux Aeterna, composed by Clint Mansell, performed by Kronos Quartet. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's seized control of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, the site of the world's largest nuclear meltdown in 1986. The Ukrainian government warns this could lead to another ecological disaster at the site. While the plant's inactive, vast amounts of radioactive nuclear waste remain. There are already reports the level of radiation in the area has increased, perhaps because Russian military vehicles have driven through the exclusion zone, disturbing contaminated soil. Chernobyl is located 10 miles from Belarus and about 80 miles from Kyiv. On Thursday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki talked about the situation at Chernobyl.
We are outraged by credible reports that Russian soldiers are currently holding the staff of the Chernobyl facilities hostage. This unlawful and dangerous hostage taking, which could upend the routine civil service efforts required to maintain and protect the nuclear waste facilities, is obviously incredibly alarming and greatly concerning. We condemn it and we request their release.
Many nuclear experts say Chernobyl is just one nuclear risk facing Ukraine, which still operates four nuclear power plants with a total of 15 nuclear reactors. A disaster could occur if any of the reactors were damaged by a military strike, whether accidental or targeted, or if the reactors were forced offline for another reason, like a power outage or a fire, or if workers fled due to a threat of violence. Bloomberg reports this marks the first time a large-scale war has been waged in an area so dependent on nuclear power. Ukraine's largest nuclear plant is located about 120 miles from the Donbas region, where separatists and the Ukrainian forces have been fighting for years. We go now to Linda Pence-Gunter. She is an international specialist at the group Beyond Nuclear, which she founded. She recently wrote an article for Counterpunch headlined "In the Line of Eternal Fire, Ukraine's Nuclear Reactors." Linda, thanks for joining us. Can you talk about the significance of Russia taking hold of the nuclear isolation area of Chernobyl, what this means, and put it into the larger context of nuclear power in Chernobyl. in Ukraine.
Certainly. And it was very moving to hear your Ukrainian guests earlier talk about the human tragedy that's already unfolding. It can only get unimaginably worse if something were to occur at any of these nuclear sites. The Chernobyl site, it's not completely clear what's happened there in terms of whether there's been any additional radioactive releases or the hostage situation. We do have a colleague who worked at the site who's no longer there but is still in touch. And what he told me yesterday was that the workforce is still in place, but they're unable to make decisions and that it is occupied by the Russian forces. So I don't know whether that constitutes a hostage situation or just an immobilization of decision-making by the workforce. But it's a very, very volatile site. The fuel that's stored there is quite unstable. In fact, less than a year ago, there was some increased neutron activity, which led to fears that there might be a chain reaction starting or even an explosion. So to have any kind of conflict raging around the Chernobyl site is of extreme alarm, and more so, I think, the active reactors that you mentioned. This is the first time that we've ever seen a war zone in a location where there are operating nuclear power plants. So that's really an unprecedented situation. And as you said, any manner of situations could lead to a catastrophic meltdown, even something as simple as the loss of off-site and then on-site power. We don't know what's going to happen to the grid in this situation. And if those reactors lose their off-site power and have to use their backup on-site power, that's usually something like diesel generators, which obviously don't last forever and don't, in fact, always work. So the whole situation is extremely alarming. Obviously, if we go to any kind of nuclear disaster, we're adding to the existing humanitarian tragedy the release of potentially a massive amount of radioactivity, which would harm not only the people within Ukraine, but would spread, depending on the direction of the wind, to Russia even and Belarus and obviously to Europe and beyond. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to contemplate that anyone would deliberately attack any of these plants. But if they're in the line of fire, they could take an accidental hit.
I mean, what about a cyber attack? And again, what about if workers are afraid to come to work, what this could mean?
Yes, a cyber attack, we've always thought was probably the most likely course of action since we know that Russia is skilled in that department already. So that it would, if anything happens like that, which would disable the control of a reactor, that is of equal concern. The situation with the workforce is that, unfortunately, nuclear power plants, even on a good day, are not walk-away safe. So therefore, you would absolutely have to maintain a workforce there, no matter what. And that's asking for a sacrifice. It was actually the sacrifice that was asked of the Fukushima Daiichi workforce by Naoto Kan, the then prime minister, when TEPCO wanted to evacuate them during that disaster. They simply cannot leave. But obviously, we're all human beings. And the temptation, if you're in the middle of a war zone, is that you want to flee with your family. And that just isn't an option for nuclear plant workers.
Talk about Zaporizhzhia, the significance and how large this area is and the fact that it's in the midst of the fighting.
Yes, I mean, I looked at a map, I think it was put out by one of the media organizations yesterday to show where there have already been explosions. And one of those indications was dangerously close to Zaporizhzhia, which is the sixth reactor site. This is the largest power plant in Europe, 5,700 megawatt output, a massive radioactive inventory. We must remember that in 1986, when Chernobyl exploded, it was a relatively new single unit. And even that caused a humanitarian disaster, which we're still seeing the results of today. Because when that radioactivity gets out, it doesn't just dissipate. It lasts forever. It gets into the DNA. We see problems down the generations of human health, birth defects, leukemias, thyroid cancers, and so on. So this is something that will go on forever if, in fact, something happens, particularly at Zaporizhzhia, because it's such a large site.
So can you talk about what needs to happen right now?
Well, as your previous speakers also addressed, we need, obviously, diplomacy and not war. That's not my area of expertise, so I don't know how that should be guided. Somebody asked me yesterday, well, why don't they just close the nuclear power plants down as a precaution, which is what happens for example, in this country, if there's a major hurricane and it's coming directly towards a nuclear plant, sometimes, not always, but they should, they start to power down and close the reactors down. In Ukraine, those 15 reactors are responsible for 50% of the electricity supply. So that's really not an option right now when you're in the middle of potentially a full-scale war to cut off 50% of your electricity. So they're in a no-win situation, as we are in the wider picture with this conflict. So we have to hope that...
We have 5 seconds.
Yes, so we hope that nobody takes the drastic action of either deliberately attacking a nuclear plant or using nuclear weapons.
Linda Pence Gunter, I want to thank you for being with us, international specialist at Beyond Nuclear. And final breaking news, President Biden is nominating Federal Appeals Court Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to be the first Black woman on the U.S. Supreme Court. That announcement is coming today. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a human resources manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Wernoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Camille Baker, Tamari A. Studio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Juan Carlos Davila, Hani Massoud, Mary Conlon. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Esto es únicamente una prueba. Uno, dos, uno, dos.
In Montreal.
CKUT. All the rhythms, all the music, all the time.
90.3 FM.
If it appears that COVID-19 symptoms like cough, fever, sore throat, and loss of taste and smell are beginning to present themselves, you can begin to self-isolate and take a rapid test at home. After getting your test results, you can learn more about proper self-isolation guidelines by visiting quebec.ca/self-isolating. This information is there to help protect you and everyone living under the same roof. All of us can make a difference, so let's keep making sure all of us are safe. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Turn into a prince suddenly. Donne-moi des peanuts, m'en va chanter alouette sans fausse note. 7h15, t'embarques dans l'autobus. Ton seul petit tour pour aller travailler. Un beau voyage en groupe organisé comme toi le matin. You're a frog, I'm a frog, kiss me.